For Wisconsinites with ties to Ukraine, no doubt the Russian invasion has been nightmarish. Russia's full-scale attack on their ancestral homeland is a serious threat to friends and family members. We learn what loved ones are going through on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to U.S. Census figures, more than 10,000 Wisconsinites identify as having a Ukrainian background. Do you have ties to Ukraine? Have you heard from your kin? How are they doing? What are your fears? It's 800-642-1234. Jonathan Polipiv is a Ukrainian-American in the village of Kimberly near Appleton. He founded a Facebook page gathering Wisconsin Ukrainians. Jonathan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me on the air today and this morning, be able to speak to the community and people. As a Wisconsin Ukrainian, I just appreciate the opportunity for people all over the state and all over the world listening to the Ukrainian voice, voice that we've not, you know, a lot of people haven't heard, so we appreciate being able to share directly from our friends and family what's happening in Ukraine and the Russian invasion.
Well, our heart goes out to you, and thank you for sharing your story and taking the time. How are you and your family doing?
You know, people ask that, and, you know, the Midwest nice thing is to say, it's like, oh, everyone's fine, things are good. Mm. The reality is people are not fine. We're not good. My family is not good. They're in war. They're alive, but there's other friends and family of ours. They're really close to where Russian troops are, and there's jets flying. There's tanks in their neighborhoods. There's bullets flying. There's rockets hitting civilian infrastructure, buildings, apartments. The Ukrainian people are not fine, but remarkably, they're incredibly calm and resolved together for fighting for their freedom and their life and their willingness just to do whatever it takes just to live as an independent nation. And that makes me extremely proud as a Ukrainian American. And I like this calmness. It's you know, that's all I hear is we're trying to remain calm. And then they're just uniting together against Putin's invasion of Ukraine.
Remain calm. You arrived in the U.S. as a child in the 90s. Can you take us into your story and how you came here?
Yes. So it's a long and a complex story, but I will just cover some of the main basics. So Ukraine voted to become independent in end of 1991. And this was after the Soviet Union was starting to collapse, and the Soviet Union decided that each you know, republic or a group of, you know, states could become, you know, they have more autonomy. Well, Ukrainians voted for independence. It was overwhelmingly strong. I believe it was like 90-some percent voted for independence. At the time, I had been living in Ternopil, which is in the western part of Ukraine, with my maternal grandmother. She had been raising me since I was a child. My biological parents died tragically when I was a young child, so she was taking care of me. But at the time, her and my grandfather lived in the village where my grandfather had been working at a collective farm, which was another thing from the Soviet Union, which was not really a great situation or system. You know, Ukraine can feed a lot of people because of its abundance of natural resources, agriculture. But the inefficiency and just the stealing of Ukrainian wealth from and the pilfering from the leadership of the Soviet Union, it just really never really materialized the opportunities Ukrainians had. So anyway, my family had been living in the village, and then my grandmother, in order for my grandmother and my grandfather to have custody of my brother and I, she had to move to the city. So this means that my grandmother lived in the city with me and my brother, while my grandfather lived in the village working on this collective farm. And it just shows their love for us. So this way we're not institutionalized in an orphanage. And then in 1992, there was a Christian a group that sponsored about 125 Ukrainian children. And that number, I just don't have exact because I've seen a couple different numbers. And I was a child when I was in this group. I was 8 years old. But in 1992, we came to the United States. We settled in the northern Wisconsin or northern Illinois, southern Wisconsin areas. And because this is because the infrastructure, it just was completely collapsing in the republics, former republics of the Soviet Union, because, you know, it's been decades and decades of Soviet rule. Things just changed, and they were changing. There's a lot of stress in the communities. So we were supposed to stay for several months. Some of us ended up staying completely in the United States, while many of the children went back to Ukraine. Mm. And we were all children deprived of parental care when we came. So that is part of my story. And I've been living in Northeast Wisconsin area majority of my adult life, except I did spend a year abroad for about a year when I was deployed with the United States military and the Wisconsin Army National Guard, doing convoy securities throughout Iraq.
You traveled to Ukraine in 2014 to visit your brother. I believe you were reunited with him. And this is a really pivotal time for Ukraine, you know, as the country had these widespread protests who wanted to oust the pro-Russia president. Can you explain a little bit about what it was like when you went back?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, and what precipitated this return is, I think anyone that has loved ones or just parts of them elsewhere, they're part of their hearts, there's this willingness and just want and desire to connect. That's what I had. After in 2013, I lost a very good military friend of mine that I deployed. He died prematurely, and it just kind of really altered a lot of the trajectory of my life. And I needed to reconnect to my family in Ukraine, because until then we were just we had grown disconnected. I was a child and I just didn't know where I belonged as a Ukrainian American living in Wisconsin. And I just felt disconnected, and I just didn't feel always like I belonged. And part of that is because I had family still in Ukraine, that was still part of my heart and my life. So in 2014, I was able to get reconnected because one of the children that was part of this group I came with, he helped me connect with my brother. It's a remarkable story. So my friend Andrei Nazarenko started a nonprofit in Ukraine called Orphans Future. And Orphans Future helps orphans transition from institutionalized living into living in society and be able to acclimate, learning how to take care of themselves, grocery shop, cook, things that they couldn't live and learn to do without having peers and mentors or parents, certainly. So my friend Andrei, he helped find my brother. He helped me connect with him. Then we started talking on Skype and Facebook, and then we made plans. Both my wife, Mara, and I, we made plans to go to Ukraine in 2014. But yes, the revolution of dignity started, the Euromaidan, because there's a regime, the Putin regime, well, very friendly, and they're just very, just the Ukrainian people had been fed up, so they overthrew this regime, and, you know, Russia didn't like that, so they were doing whatever they could. So at this time, I had made plans, my wife and I made plans, but we were determined that at least I was going to go. Mm. So at the time, my wife was pregnant, so we made a decision that she shouldn't come to Ukraine. She was due in July. At this time, it was March, so we just thought, you know what, it'd be best if I just go, and I did. When I returned, it was just eye-opening how much different Ukraine was. It wasn't like the Soviet Union that I had been living under. It almost is like that moment of when you're watching The Wizard of Oz and it's in black and white, and then you see the color just transform before you.
Wow.
What it felt like. It was so surreal. Mm. Because not only did I came back to an independent nation, but I came back to the beauty and the culture and the people and the hospitality that I've been missing. And that it made my heart so full. I felt so loved, and I felt so a part of my family. And it was one of the most remarkable journeys in my life. And I am just so grateful for that opportunity. Because, you know, when I left Ukraine, it had already been voted to become independent. Mm-hmm. So I did live in an independent Ukraine briefly. And then when I returned, it was an independent Ukraine. And now I just want to be able to return to an independent Ukraine again, where my family and my friends can live in peace, and they can live into the full maximum capacity that the Ukrainian people and the land can provide. It's just a truly a beautiful place, and I enjoy my journey there. So I traveled to different parts of the areas. My wife did make me tell me not to go to Kyiv because of the protests or the revolution
at that time.
Euromaidan happened, so I didn't do that. But I did go to an area just a bit north of Crimea. You know, Russia had been invading Crimea. The war had already started in 2014, and even in eastern Ukraine, there was war starting there. But people just didn't really know all the extent of it. The Russian occupation forces had wanted to push further into Ukraine, and the Ukrainian people stood up and they pushed back as much as they could until the Ukrainian military built up. So, but I'm sorry, back to the original part. But that was my journey back to Ukraine in 2014.
Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us and sharing a bit of your story. We appreciate it. Jonathan Polipov is a Ukrainian-American in the Fox Valley. Just ahead, a UW political scientist who studies Russian nationalism explains what Moscow wants. You can join in 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. News reports say President Putin ordered Russian nuclear forces to be put on high alert Sunday in response to what he called aggressive statements by leading NATO powers. The U.S. said Putin was escalating the war in a totally unacceptable way. We're asking questions about the East-West tensions on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. What puzzles you about why Putin isn't invading Ukraine? What do you want to know about separatist territories or relations since 2014 when Russia first invaded annexing Crimea? What about humanitarian aid and where people fleeing will go? 800-642-1234. Yoshiko Herrera is a political science professor at UW-Madison with expertise in the politics of Russia and other post-Soviet states. Yoshiko, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much.
Good morning. So we see Ukrainian and Russian officials start to engage in the beginning of peace talks, no preconditions. Do you see a diplomatic solution here? Do you see a diplomatic path forward?
It's hard to be really optimistic about these because the Ukrainian position at this point, they want to preserve their sovereignty, and that means getting Russian troops out of Ukraine. But it's hard to see the Russians agreeing to that because they decided on their own, for some reason, to invade Ukraine, and the war isn't going very well for them. There was lots of options for Russia to choose not to do this or to choose a more limited military incursion into the east where there was an ongoing war. So it's hard to see Putin, given how much is at stake, given how much damage he's already done to Russia politically, economically, socially, how he just agrees to withdraw. So it seems that both sides have demands that are going to be unlikely to be agreed to by the other side.
You study Russian politics, have so for decades, and direct the UW-Madison partnership with a university in Kazakhstan near the Russian border. What are you hearing from your colleagues, your friends, people in Russia and Ukraine?
Yeah, just a slight clarification. I'm a former director of that.
Oh, former. I'm sorry.
Partnership. But, I think that, this story is just... it's evolving into a major story, not just of Eurasia, but also of international relations, of democracy versus dictatorship, et cetera. So I think it is evolving into an incredibly impactful set of events. I think that, you know, there's a lot of discussion of why did Putin do it? And also, relatedly, has Putin gone mad? The images of him sitting at these long tables away from everybody, you know, sort of suggest a strange isolation. And some people, including myself, have called this a major miscalculation. I think he was wrong about the military aspect and how quick it would be. He expected a quick victory. He was absolutely wrong about the resilience and resolve of the Ukrainian people. He's been wrong about the international effects. And I think he's wrong about the reaction in Russia. So it's a huge mistake. But is he, you know, psychologically fit or not? I don't necessarily want to go into that, but mm-hmm. I think there's no question that this has been a disaster for Russia as well as a humanitarian disaster for Ukraine.
I wonder, does Putin perceive that Western democracies are in a weakened and vulnerable state right now? So that makes this moment to launch a military incursion the right time for him?
Yeah, the specific timing is a matter of debate. Why did he do this right now? You could say he thought he has taken risks before. Mm-hmm. He's absolutely willing to use violence to remain in power. He's increasingly using violence against people in Russia to maintain power, including arresting thousands of people since this invasion began, and very prominently attempting to assassinate and then arrest his main opposition opponent, Alexei Navalny, who's still in jail. But Putin, you know, in his time in office has undertaken risky and violent actions before. So you could say, well, you know, this is just par for the course. But I think the specific timing is kind of, people are wondering about that, why this war has been going on in the East since 2014, like what makes February of 2022 the time? He could have been overconfident due to seeming victories in Georgia 2008, Syria 2015, Ukraine 2014. But still, because I think it was such a massively wrong thing to do, it's hard to say, oh, this explains why this was the right time. I mean, it looks like it was never would have been the right time, but it's not clear. He may have underestimated. I think I think he did underestimate the ability of the U.S. and European allies to work together. I mean, lots of people had questions about whether the sanctions regime would come together because it's so costly for Europe and to some extent for the U.S. So I think he was overconfident, but the precise timing of why this year, I don't think, or this month, this year is exactly clear yet.
Yoshiko Herrera with us, UW-Madison political science professor. Research focuses on the politics of Russia, other post-Soviet states. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Yoshiko, what is now Ukraine has been a contested region, with shifting borders for centuries. Can you explain the breakaway regions and Putin saying that Ukraine was always part of Russia?
Yeah, I guess my view is that the Soviet Union broke up in December 1991. Mm-hmm. There are 15 successor states. Those states are all recognized as international states with set boundaries. And so there's a lot of post-colonial, post-imperial states in which the boundaries of the nation and the state are not exactly overlapping, or that borders have changed. You know, Poland is a country with a lot of changed borders. But in 2022, there's no question what the borders of Ukraine should be. The only question is that Russia had invaded Crimea in 2014, and it was supporting an ongoing war in the East since 2014. But Ukraine as a state was accepted by basically all other states in the world, including Russia. So I don't think there's much, I don't think it's right to take the Putin line that, well, you know, this is really part of Russia and it's not really a real state. I mean, Putin is denying the sovereignty of Ukraine and denying the nationhood of the Ukrainian people. But that is a, I'd say that's a minority argument.
Hmm.
There is, you know, a long history of relationship between Ukraine and Russia going back centuries. But it, you know, it's a little bit like, you look at Scandinavia and you say, well, maybe at one time they were all Vikings. But that doesn't mean Norway, Sweden, Finland don't exist as separate states today.
Hmm. Political science professor Yoshika Herrera here with analysis of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, now entering the fifth day. President Putin frequently accused Ukraine of being taken over by extremists ever since its pro-Russian president was ousted in 2014. What questions do you have about what's happened since then? What do you think the West can do, should do? Do you think there's a diplomatic way out? 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up with Yoshika Herrera after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. Talks between Russian and Ukrainian delegations are taking place at the Belarus border for what Ukrainian President Zelensky described as the beginning stages of peace talks. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Meanwhile, the 193-member UN General Assembly has set an emergency session on Russia's invasion. Do you want a fuller explanation as to why Putin says Ukraine isn't a real country? What questions do you have about Russian chauvinism and how it came to be? Join in with questions on Russia, Moscow's intentions, 800-642-1234. Yoshika Herrera is a UW-Madison political science professor whose research includes U.S.-Russian relations and is with us for the rest of the hour. Yoshika, you know, most Ukrainians are either able to speak or easily understand both Russian and Ukrainian languages. And I'm wondering if you can explain the social and cultural ties that bind Russia and Ukraine that really complicate the president. I mean, we saw Zelensky give this impassioned speech last week in Russian.
Yes. So this is an important aspect of the conflict. There is, let's say, a sportsmanlike rivalry between Ukrainians and Russians, I would say, like, before this conflict erupted, in the sense that they are, they both speak languages that derive from a Slavic root, but they're different languages. There's a lot of overlap. There's about 30% overlap in the words. Most Ukrainian speakers also speak Russian, as you said, and tens of millions of people in Russia have direct family ties with Ukrainian relatives, or they could have Russian relatives also living in Ukraine, because there's a lot of ethnic Russians and Russian speakers also living in Ukraine. In addition, there's a lot of intermarriage, and Ukrainians are the largest non-ethnic Russian minority within Russia. So there's just lots and lots of family ties. I mean, if you think of our region here in Wisconsin, you think of Wisconsin, Minnesota, you know, there's a lot of people who have family in both states.
Sure.
People might have Wisconsin pride or Minnesota pride, but you know, there's just a lot of overlap. So it's not at all a case of hostility like some cases like Palestinian or Israeli, where there isn't a lot of overlapping family ties. However, there are some important tensions or conflicts in the past, notably during collectivization in the Soviet Union in early 1930s, there was a famine in Ukraine that many people in Ukraine consider to be a genocide. A lot of scholars consider it to be a genocide where Ukrainians died. This is under Stalin, and so that's a flashpoint in terms of discussion. A lot of Russian commentators think it was they acknowledge it was a famine, but they think it was an accident rather than a genocide. So there are serious tensions.
I want to jump in. I just want to jump in there because at that famine, because Jerry in Appleton would like to probe that further. Jerry, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. My grandparents, two of them emigrated from Ukraine, so I've always been somewhat interested in the history. And Professor Herrera stole my thunder a little bit, but my question is, to what extent does that famine, which killed up to 10 million Ukrainians, to what extent does that resonate with modern-day Ukrainians? And do Ukrainians harbor bad feelings about Russians because of that?
Jerry, thank you.
Well, yeah, that's a great question. Okay, it is a central part of Ukrainian national identity, I would say. So there's no one in Ukraine that hasn't heard of it. There's no one in Ukraine who has no opinion on it. I mean, it's a central part of the identity. However, I think it is mainly directed as an anti-Soviet regime kind of sentiment. So it's not that Ukrainians necessarily blame ethnic Russians, but they certainly blame the Soviet regime. And that's why they are absolutely set on not returning to a Soviet-style political system. Putin, for his part, has said he wants to re-establish, or he has said that the end of the Soviet Union, you know, is the greatest tragedy of the 20th century. It's clear he has kind of imperial ambitions. And so I think the Putin regime is very closely associated with a Soviet-style regime, which is, you know, which is the main, I think, target of the famine. So while it's absolutely central, I don't think it translates into hating Russian people per se, but certainly deep hostility towards any kind of Soviet regime.
And further there, Putin and his inner circle, they are products of the Cold War. And I'm wondering, is the current conflict, do you think, a renewal or even a continuation of the Cold War sentiment, being that the goal is to perhaps restore Russia as America's greatest military rival?
Well, Putin certainly has these ambitions to raise Russia's status. You know, it wouldn't be the same kind of Cold War just because we don't have the bipolarity, you know, with the rise of China and Europe, et cetera. But that was a longstanding goal of his, was to bring respect and status to Russia and have Russia be taken seriously. But the amazing irony is that he has done just the opposite. I mean, he has destroyed Russia as a Russia's reputation as a country internationally for years to come. So he's just acted in a totally counterproductive way, even though I do think that sense of humiliation from the end of the Soviet Union was one of the motivating factors for him in this conflict.
Talking with UW-Madison political science professor Yoshika Herrera, an expert on politics in Russia. You can join in 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the invasion? How should the U.S. or the U.N. respond at this point? What are you watching for? Join in 800-642-1234. Yoshiko, it seems the Kremlin's invasion is really centered on removing Zelensky from power to taking power of the government. And one thing that I've noticed absurdly that Putin has used is this disinformation or just false conspiracy, even suggesting that Zelensky's administration comprises Nazis. What is Putin doing there?
Yeah, I think it seems fairly clear that Putin thought that he would be able to remove the Zelensky government and replace it with a more pro-Russian government. That is not happening. Zelensky is not leaving easily. Ukrainians are not folding and accepting that. But why is Putin targeting Zelensky? He has, I think one way to think about it is that Putin thinks that Ukrainians, he doesn't acknowledge their nationhood. So he thinks that they are sort of Russians who are gone bad, apostates, that they should be Russian, but they're sort of behaving wrongly and you can punish them into submission. And that's turning out to be totally, totally wrong. Calling Zelensky a Nazi, saying he's fighting Nazism, there's a couple of different things going on there. One is it's hearkening back to World War II, where Ukrainian nationalists did partner with Germany against the Soviet Union. There's lots of reasons you could debate why they did that, but Ukrainian nationalists were fighting the Soviets during the Soviet Union. So it's part of Putin's, you know, going back to the past of let's relive this Soviet times. But anti-Nazism, maybe Putin thought, is going to garner support within Russia and externally. So labeling the Zelensky, by the way, is Jewish. So it's even more absurd. But trying to label them as neo-Nazis is just an attempt by Putin to legitimate what he's doing. But I guess I want to just note that there's lots of time and space to debate Ukrainian policies, Ukrainian nationalism, but Putin is using this history and this supposed historical debates as a cover for just a reckless invasion. So I think it's important to put the context of historical debate in there, that is talking about, you know, did Ukrainians do this or that wrong thing, is a way to distract from what Putin is doing. Hmm.
Let's bring in Peter in Spooner. Peter, hi.
Hi. I was an exchange student in 1990, the Soviet Union, the later days of Gorbachev. One of the things that I even noticed at that age was how important it was for, at that time, the Soviets, but it was in Russia, to like demonstrate like how important they were as a state. And I heard someone the other day talk about how the state of Russia, not the people itself, almost is like a vulnerable narcissist, where it needs reassurance. It needs to be reassured that it's important and an important actor in the world. And yet they have the economy the size of Italy. I'm just wondering what the professor thinks of that line of reasoning. And is it something that almost needs to be nurtured or coddled to feel good about itself? Is that what led to this?
Peter, thank you.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think that there is a narrative of humiliation after the end of the Soviet Union that was deeply, that resonated deeply within Russia. I mean, let me just step back and say for a moment, Russia as a country, you know, minus Putin, but just if you think about Russia as a country, it is a great country in terms of its contributions to literature, art, science, et cetera. There's a lot of things you could say, well, you know, this country did a lot of good things in its time, despite the dictatorship, et cetera, and the political system. So the loss of status from the Soviet period to the post-Soviet period, and especially in the 90s, and 1990 is probably, you know, one of the low points there. You could see that was humiliating to a lot of people. And so Putin's narrative of the Soviet Union has been wronged, we were tricked with NATO expansion, et cetera, the West is out to get us, those kinds of things, those did resonate with a lot of people in the population and probably are part of his support that he's had over time. I mean, another part of his support is a consistent attack on opposition and voter fraud and media manipulation, et cetera. But I think there was a sense of humiliation after the end of the Soviet Union that did resonate with people. And there probably was some desire, not just by Putin's regime, but by others to return to some level of Soviet strength or greatness.
UW Madison political scientist and Russia expert Yoshiko Herrera stays with us. Are you in the military? What concerns do you have about nationalism and extremism? Are you Ukrainian? Do you know someone who lives there? What are you hearing? What are your fears? Still time, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Yoshiko Herrera on the Ideas Network. The morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Yoshiko Herrera, analysis on the Russian invasion of Ukraine now in its fifth day. Her focus is on politics in Russia, social identities and norms, nationalism and ethnic politics, among other areas. Still time for your questions about what President Putin wants out of Ukraine and NATO. 800-642-1234. Yoshiko Herrera with us for about 9 more minutes. I want to turn to China for a moment. Before Russia invaded Ukraine, American officials repeatedly pressured China to prevent this. That's according to the New York Times. How influential could China be in this conflict and Russia politics?
Well, China could be very important, and it remains to be seen which direction China is going, because there's conflicting signals. On the one hand, Chinese propaganda within the state is sort of repeating Russian media and Putin's line. So you could say from that angle, China is going along with Russia. But they're mostly repeating the anti-Americanism, anti-NATO stuff that they promote as a matter of course anyways. Hmm. I think the key thing is going to be whether China goes along with the sanctions and in particular some of the export to Russia sanctions, some of the banking sanctions, et cetera. So I think early indications is that China isn't going to go against the sanctions regime, which is bad for Russia. And I think another question that's not clear is we don't really know when exactly did Putin make the decision to invade. Mm. Did he make the decision a year ago? Did he make it a week ago? And did he communicate and share that information with Xi Jinping in China? And I think that's important in terms of understanding how trustworthy Russia would be seen by China. So I think it's a little bit of an evolving story there, but China could back up Russia in some important ways, or it could sort of step back and just allow other countries to punish Russia without intervening.
The UN holding a rare emergency session today of its General Assembly to vote on a resolution calling for peace. Could that have any effect?
Well, I think there's lots of pieces of the international case for pressure against Russia. Mm-hmm. So some people might say, well, this UN resolution won't do anything. Another way to look at it is all of these sanctions and statements and things that are being done internationally, they all add up to a very strong case that the world is against Putin's actions. So I think, you know, is the UN resolution itself going to stop Putin? No, but it's going to be a piece of a larger international story that is going to be increasingly hard for the Putin regime to hide from the Russian people and to counter. I mean, they can't keep saying we are in the right when every country is turning against them.
On the flip side, there's also new EU measures, including a pledge to provide weapons, to provide ammunition, fuel to the Ukrainian army. How is foreign policy changing in this moment?
Oh, it's changing quite a bit. I mean, Germany is a very important piece of this. They went from taking a pacifist stand, not wanting to get involved, to, you know, it's almost a 180-degree turn to becoming very involved. Other countries like Poland are at the forefront in terms of trying to support Ukraine. And I think the support militarily, the idea of support militarily for Ukraine has garnered a lot more steam in recent days. So Europe has really come together. Even neutral countries like Switzerland are saying they're going to go along with the sanctions. So there's just been a big change in Europe in terms of coming together to show opposition to the Putin regime.
Let's go to Tom in Oshkosh. Tom, what are your thoughts?
Thank you. Our family married into a Russian family down in Milwaukee, and we were visiting with them. This whole situation has kind of torn that family apart in that they listen a lot to the Russian media news that's available, and the elders in that family are very supportive of Putin. They see what Putin has done is overthrown or attempting to overthrow an illegitimate government that has been put in place and is crushing the Russian population there. They likened it to what we did in Iraq and even went back to Vietnam. The other members of the family are very much against what has been happening with Putin. It has torn them apart. It got a little bit contentious. We had to change the subjects and all agree that this was not appropriate. It's almost much the same as some things that have been happening in this country when we had President Trump in power. So, and one other thing that your guests might be able to clarify is they were contending that the sanctions that we are putting in place mean little to Putin and the Russian population because they had so much time to prepare for the sanctions and to take other moves to countermand them because they had so much warning that these sanctions might go.
Tom, thank you for sharing. Yoshiko, how would you respond to Tom?
Yeah, that's actually a great set of points. The division that he noted in his relatives there, I think, is a division you're seeing in Russia. Putin supporters, for the moment, are still supporting him, and there's a lot of opposition. He's, you know, arresting and beating up the opposition. But I think there's probably going to be a limit. I mean, this is a question, like, what is it going to take for Putin supporters to stop accepting the narrative that he is feeding them? People are already seeing the effects on the economy. So I think that's a question of, like, when, if ever, will people realize that Putin is actually ruining the country and maybe stop supporting him? On the sanctions, many people thought the sanctions would not deter Putin. That's correct. However, the sanctions have been much broader and much stronger. And in particular, one of the key pieces is that Putin had amassed $643 billion in foreign currency reserves to counteract the sanctions. But a lot of that money is held outside of Russia, and the US and Europe are now not allowing the central bank to access that. So the central bank sanctions that were announced over the weekend are a critical piece in counteracting the moves that Putin had made to insulate Russia from the sanctions.
Very quickly, what are you watching for next?
I'm watching for what's happening. Well, there's two things. One is Russia could turn to a much more violent, brutal strategy in Ukraine militarily. And so I'm very concerned about Ukraine and whether as much resolve and will they have, like, can they withstand a much worse onslaught from the Russian military? That's one thing. And of course, I'm hoping for peace there. But the other thing is what's happening within Russia in terms of the support for Putin and whether the protests are going to grow, the economic damage is going to grow, and whether he is going to be able to withstand the international and domestic pressure against his regime.
Yoshiko, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Yoshiko Herrera, professor in political science at UW-Madison, expert on politics in Russia. I'm Kedar Cherkent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.